Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world. In this third installment of our series on climate change, we're going outside. These days, when you hear the phrase climate change, you may think COP26, which just ended. It may conjure up images of protesters, Greta Thunberg, or maybe you think of all the dramatic weather events of the last summer. Whatever it is, we're often thinking of climate change on a global scale, which can make it seem a bit abstract. But of course, climate change is also local. For this episode, I thought I would go local and see what impact climate change is having where I live in New York State. To learn more, I met with ecologist and biogeochemist Andy Reinman at Black Rock Forest.
We've really got the fall color going now.
Yeah.
Andy Reinman is an assistant professor in the Environmental Sciences Initiative at the Advanced Science Research Center of CUNY, and also in the Department of Geography and Environmental Science at Hunter College in New York City. But he does much of his research at Black Rock Forest, a beautiful nearly 4,000-acre expanse of hills and valleys punctuated by lakes in the Hudson Highlands. Not that far from West Point, George Washington's headquarters during the Revolutionary War, where a 150-ton iron chain was slung across the Hudson River to block the passage of British ships. In addition to being a lovely place to hike, Black Rock Forest is a scientific field station. It was established as a research forest in 1929 by its then owner, Dr. Ernest G. Stillman, who left it to Harvard University at his death in 1949. In the 1960s, it was nearly drowned by Con Edison, which wanted to create a reservoir to support a power plant on nearby Storm King Mountain. A number of environmental groups, including the Nature Conservancy, early founders of the National Resources Defense Council, and Scenic Hudson, filed a lawsuit to block this plan, setting off a 20-year battle which is considered by some the genesis of the modern environmental movement in the U.S. Then in 1989, Black Rock Forest was bought by a consortium including the American Museum of Natural History, universities such as Columbia, and a number of other schools. These days, it's one of the places where scientists keep watch on the impact of climate change. To reach the part of Black Rock Forest where Andy conducts his research, we drive up a narrow one-lane dirt road where some tricky negotiations have to be handled when we encounter a car coming downhill. At the top, we park overlooking a pond where a group of Boy Scouts are busy chopping and sorting firewood under the supervision of forest manager Matt Brady. From there, we walk up a hill, encounter some of Andy's students who are busy measuring the circumference of tree trunks. As we're walking, looking at the trees, we can't help but talk about what a strange fall it's been.
I was wondering, it feels like the colors are coming later this year.
And Andy explains to me that it's not just the photoperiod, the amount of light in a given day, that triggers the trees to get ready to drop their leaves, but temperature. A warm fall does make the leaves change color later.
You know, you think about it from the tree's perspective, as winter is coming, they've got a lot of things that they got to prepare for. And so they want to make sure that they're getting as much of the nutrient content of the leaves out of the leaf and stored in their own tissue before they drop the leaves. Because once they drop the leaves, then those nutrients in there are up for grabs by anybody.
When we get to the top of the hill, on a bank covered by hay-scented ferns, there's a large wooden structure with staircases on it, like a tall scaffolding up to the sky.
All right, so that's the PhenoCam. So it's a camera that records phenology, is that the idea?
Yep, it takes pictures in a sort of a northward direction so that the canopy is never backlit. And then it uses the color spectrum in the image to quantify different metrics of like greenness. And it uses that, you can go to a website and you can see the green up period, the changes in greenness during the growing season, and then the fall senescence period.
So phenology is a term that has to do with the seasons. Can you, for my listeners who might not be familiar with the term?
Yeah, so phenology, broadly speaking, is just the timing of cyclical natural events. And so there's many different contexts that we can use the term phenology. It could be the migration of birds from their tropical wintering grounds to their summer breeding grounds up here. In this context here, we're talking about the seasonal cycles of leaf on and leaf off phases of trees in our temperate deciduous forests.
And the camera is able to judge those by color primarily.
By color, yeah. Yep, that's right. And it's this amazing network. There's hundreds of these cameras all over the world now. They send the pictures sort of automatically to a database that's housed at University of New Hampshire. And you can go to that website and click on any of the PhenoCams, either look at specific images, or they put together automatically this graph of that annual cycle of greenness. And you can look at it across the years that a camera's been there. You can look at it within an individual year. And it's a really great way for us to track the interannual variations in those phenological cycles for the same location where the picture is taken the exact same way with the same camera in the same spot year after year. And you can start to do things like understand, well, why does it vary from year to year? What are the environmental controls of that? And in places where you're making other measurements related to, let's say, carbon sequestration in a forest, you can start to sync those phenology patterns with things related to carbon cycling. Or if you're an animal person, you can sync it to things like when caterpillars come out and then the extent to which there's a mismatch between the emergence of caterpillars and the arrival of birds coming up here for their summer breeding grounds.
Right, interesting. So is it early enough that this imagery has told us something about the impact of climate change here, or are we still gathering the data?
Have had this camera here for 2 years now.
Oh, okay.
So.
But in general, I mean, because I imagine this isn't the only
camera, right? It's not. I don't know that there's sites where these cameras have been up for the numerous decades you would need to track that. Because the climate change thing, it's not any 1 year that you're looking for as an indicator of climate change. That's right. It's the trends over time.
Yeah.
But we know some of the metrics, the climate variables that this is related to, and there's lots of places that have long-term data sets of temperature and first and last frost dates and when ice on a lake starts and when it comes out and all these other metrics that are also related to phenology that we can sort of stitch together a reasonable assumption of how these things might be changing over time. In addition to these cameras, though, there are some sites that have had different types of data collection in place for over 30 years now, where there are these towers that stick above the forest and they measure the amount of carbon being taken up by a forest and doing this at minute by minute time scale. So you can track when during the year does that carbon uptake start and when does it end. So that's another way of kind of getting
that
phenology. So it's this really brilliant concept. So as air moves across the top of a forest canopy, it sort of starts rolling across in these eddies, right? So you have air moving down into the forest and then air moving from the forest out into the atmosphere. And this is, of course, like an oversimplification of the physics behind it. But basically, these towers have sensors that measure wind speed and wind direction, both horizontally and vertically. And they also have these sensors that are measuring carbon dioxide concentrations. So essentially, what they can do is they can measure the amount of carbon dioxide in the air going into the forest and the amount of carbon dioxide in the air coming out of the forest.
Wow.
And the difference between those is what the forest is storing, or if it's nighttime, what the forest is releasing. And so you can go back in time in those records and see how things are changing over time, and you can see what the sorts of climate variables that might be driving interannual variations and those sorts of things.
So what are some of the general trends? I mean, I'm sure a lot of it is predictions at this point, but in this eastern deciduous forest, if that's how one would classify it.
Eastern temperate deciduous forest.
What are some of the things that you imagine are going to happen due to climate change?
That's a really good question. I mean, there's a lot of research trying to figure this out. Some of our work from northern New England, where there we're learning that winter snowpack is actually really important for the productivity in the forest in the subsequent growing season. And this has been work that we've done and some others have done over the past 20 years or so, where through a series of what we call snowpack manipulation experiments, which is really just a fancy way of saying that a graduate student and a shovel go out into the forest during the winter, remove some of the snow to sort of simulate a later accumulation of snowpack or an earlier melting of snowpack, and then we can track how the forest responds to that. So unlike where we are here at Black Rock Forest, in northern New England, the snowpack starts to develop by late November, early December, and it stays there in most years until early April, right? So you get this continuous snowpack that gets quite deep. And even though winter air temperatures can get to be 30 degrees Celsius below zero, the soils rarely freeze below the top couple of centimeters. And so that blanket of snow is acting exactly as that, as a blanket covering the soil, helps to keep the warmth in the soil that has accumulated during the growing season. It decouples air temperature and soil temperature, and so you kind of get this comparatively balmy soil environment during the winter while the air temperatures above the soil are quite cold. What we're learning is that in the absence of that snowpack, when you get a blast of cold winter air, the soils freeze to a much greater depth. This winds up killing a lot of the fine roots in the soil, and then that has this cascade of ecosystem responses. So with that increase in root mortality in the spring, when you get the snow melt, a lot more of the nutrients are lost from the soil because the roots aren't there to take them up. It seems that, especially for sugar maple trees, that decline in root biomass results in pretty large declines in rates of tree growth. And it's probably because a lot of their resources have to go into rebuilding their root systems, and they're not taking up nutrients in the same way that they were because their roots have been impacted. And so through this series of different ecosystem responses, we're learning that the snowpack, even though it's in the winter, has important implications for rates of tree growth and forest growth during the following growing season. We're also learning a whole lot about how it impacts the microbes in the soil and things like that. So if future conditions are such that the snowpack becomes more intermittent or soil freezing increases, that can negatively impact forest growth. To build on that experiment, we in 2013-2014 started another experiment to ask what is often a question that we get asked when we present on this work. It's like, okay, well, you're simulating that changes in winter climate, but the growing season is going to be warmer and longer. So what's the impact of that? And there had been other experiments that focused just on the warming piece. What we did is we did an experiment where we manipulated snow in the winter, we warmed things during the summer, and what we find is that warming alone can increase rates of tree growth, but when it's coupled with freezing in the winter, any of the benefits from warming get almost completely erased. And so it sort of highlights the complexities involved in how our forests respond to climate, which is why when you ask me that question, it's like a little bit of a head scratcher because there's so many complicated pieces that we don't fully understand. Other things that we're learning are really important are that while we're getting warmer, longer growing seasons, it's not clear if that necessarily means that trees will grow faster or that our forests will store more carbon. As an example, forests to our south don't necessarily grow substantially faster than our forests here. And if it were just a growing season length and temperature thing, we might expect that to be the case. And so there's other things that happen along with a warmer, longer growing season. Water stress can increase, the water demand by a tree can increase, the frequency of time when temperatures sort of breach that optimum temperature photosynthesis, that can increase. And so all of these things are sort of interacting with one another to influence the way a tree grows. And these are all really hot topics of research, trying to understand, like, really, how is carbon sequestration in our forest going to change from a changing climate?
Yeah, that's fascinating. So one element, as you're saying, there's so many elements and so many that are probably known and X amount that are unknown as well that are going to influence all this, right? One factor I imagine is that this is going to favor some species over others, right?
Yep,
so
probably.
What are your thoughts on that?
So in our region, we are sort of in the heart of the oak range, and we're sort of at the southern edge, the southern climatic edge of trees like sugar maple. And so probably what we're going to find over time is that the oaks increase even more so in their dominance. The sugar maples will probably decline. These things can have long lags with climate change because once a tree is established and in the canopy, it can endure a much wider range of climate conditions than its sapling equivalent, right? And so a lot of our trees here are pretty long-lived. They can live 200 to 400 years. And so those changes, we're likely to see them first in the understory. So we're likely to see fewer and fewer sugar maple seedlings and saplings and more oak saplings and maybe some hickory as well. Our oaks, they can grow fast, they can store a lot of carbon. So from a carbon sequestration perspective, we might not see huge impacts as long as those changes in climate are not also impacting the capacity of those oaks to photosynthesize and grow and do those things that we want them to do. Other species like yellow birch will probably start to inch northward, of course, not the individuals, but as a species. And then mixed in with all of this that is really difficult to predict is how invasive species will play into the mix and shape what happens. And we have a bunch knocking at our doorstep here. We have a bunch that are already established. Many of them show signs of maybe being benefited by changes in climate. And so it's a little bit of a guess about what our forest will look like in the future. But from climate alone, we can expect more oak, less sugar maple.
I heard anecdotally this morning that it was a good year for mushrooms and slugs, a bad year for chipmunks and squirrels.
Yeah.
So is there some truth to that?
Yeah. In our forest, yeah, that's probably the case. So it's been so wet. And yeah, like anecdotally, I've seen more mushrooms this year than I think I ever have before. But the acorn piece is really interesting. So at least up here at higher elevations above 400 or 600 feet. In May of 2020, there was a late frost that came through, killed all the oak leaves and killed all the flowers. The red oaks, it's like a two-year cycle for acorn production. And so this year, there's very few red oak acorns. There's a large number of white oak and chestnut oak, but definitely a deficit from red oak, black oak, and those species. And so, of course, that would make the chipmunks and small mammals and even deer a little bit hard hit by that.
Interesting. So this question is a little bit parenthetical to the work that you do, but obviously from a human-centric perspective, one of the things that we're looking to forests for is carbon sequestration. So it sounds like we're not sure what impact climate change is going to have on that, but what sort of questions are scientists asking about the role that forests are going to play, reforestation in some areas, and how that has to factor in a changing planet?
Yeah, those are great questions. I wish I had good answers for all of them. But so I'll start with a high-level component here, and that is that globally, our vegetated ecosystems, mostly forests, are offsetting about a third of all of anthropogenic carbon dioxide emissions to the atmosphere, right? So put that another way, the carbon sequestration that's happening in our ecosystems is slowing the rate of climate change by offsetting carbon emissions by about a third. What still remains unknown is the extent to which that carbon sequestration capacity of our forests will continue into the future, or will it increase in some forests, decrease in others? And if so, what's the net effect of that? And so there's a lot of research trying to understand how our forests might respond to those conditions. And we definitely don't have an answer to that. Just as soon as there's one paper that comes out that says X, there's another paper that comes out that says Y. And so I think a lot of what we need to understand better, and there's a lot of work on this, is what's really the role of a longer and warmer growing season? What's really the role of higher carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere? We know that in some conditions, more CO2 in the atmosphere can stimulate tree growth, and it can make the trees use water more efficiently. On the other hand, there's work that shows that yes, CO2 can stimulate tree growth, but only if there's enough nitrogen and other nutrients in the soil to facilitate that. And so there's all of these different moving parts, and how they all kind of fit together to give us the answer to the question is still a little bit of a mystery. I think also thinking about what are the effects of water stress in our region of the world, the climate is expected to get wetter. But at the same time, there's also projections for greater amounts of water stress, which seems like they are opposed to one another. But the reasoning behind that, or the thinking behind that, is that as the growing seasons get longer, there's going to be more period of time when the trees are pulling water out of the soil. And with hotter conditions, their demand for water on any given day is going to be hotter. And so it seems that maybe the increases in precipitation aren't going to be able to offset the increases in demand. And so how does that affect the, you know, rates of forest growth? And so there's a lot of complicated pieces here. There's a lot of great scientists doing really cool work, chipping away at different components of that. But there's a lot that we don't fully understand.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit more about your research specifically and how that intersects with, or doesn't intersect with what we're talking about.
Yeah, sure. So here at Black Rock Forest, one of the things that we've been investigating over the past couple of years is how do forests in these topographically complex environments where you have here, you have these drier ridgetops and these pretty dry slopes, but then these wet or mesic is the term that we use, valleys in those sorts of areas, how might climate change be similarly or differently impacting those different components of our forest? A lot of what we understand about how forests respond to variations in climate tends to come from these flatter landscapes. Earlier on, I mentioned those towers above the forest that measure CO2 going in and out of a forest. Those are amazing, but they generally only work in pretty homogeneous landscapes. And so the extent to which we can take those data and apply it to a system like Black Rock Forest, we're still not certain about. And so what we've been doing here is we use tree cores to reconstruct rates of tree growth going back in time. And we compare that with climate data. And we can look at this at different landscape positions, you know, these drier areas versus wetter areas and so on. And what we've been finding is that while everyone's experiencing the same climate, the trees growing up in these ridgetops like where we are now have 2 to 3 times the amount of variability in growth from year to year compared to the trees in the valley. When we look at the amount of water that's available to trees in the soil, we find similar amounts of variability. In our valleys, the water that's available to trees tends to be much more stable, but on these hill slopes and ridgetops, it's much more variable. And so in our wet years, the trees here can do just fine. As you can see, they're shorter, but they also are a little bit more spaced than the trees in the valley. And so when they have plenty of water, they also have a ton of light at their access. But in the slightly drier years, these soils dry out really fast, which means the trees need to shut down more frequently, and that can greatly hinder rates of growth. We're also learning that under certain types of drought conditions, we don't see much of a change of trees in the valley, but we can see drastic changes in these forests up here. So 2 years ago, there was what's called a flash drought, which is just a short, intense event where maybe temperatures are warm, and just over the course of a few weeks of no precipitation, you can have a huge change in soil moisture. Statistically, these generally don't get counted as droughts because they're too short. But in 2019, this event, even though it was only a few weeks long, was severe enough, and I guess at the right time of year, that it caused the trees on the ridgetops and the hill slopes to lose their leaves about a month earlier than normal while everything in the valley was still green. So if those types of events become more frequent, probably these sorts of environments, these hilltops and such, are going to be much more adversely impacted than the trees in the valley. Other work that we've been using similar research approaches for is to try and understand not just how these large areas of intact forest sequester carbon and respond to climate, but how do areas of fragmented forest, which is about 25% or so of the forest in the northeastern quarter of the U.S., is pretty close to an edge. How does that change in the configuration of forests affect the way they grow? And what we find in fragmented landscapes of New England and New York is as you get closer to the edge of a forest, the forest actually can take up carbon about twice as fast as a forest in the center of a forested landscape. But they also seem to be much more adversely impacted by heat than a forest in the interior. So we have this weird interaction between changes in land cover and changes in climate. And it's another one of those examples of we can't really look at any one of these things in isolation, because at the same time that our climate is changing, the configuration of the ecosystems in our landscape are also changing. And if we don't take both of those into account, our projections of how much carbon our ecosystems might be sequestering 20, 30, 40 years down the line are going to be off. And part of what goes into the policies that we develop to mitigate climate change hinge in part on what we know or what we can expect our forest ecosystems to do from a carbon sequestration perspective, because that helps us to understand how much we can still put into the atmosphere. Of course, I have a bias as an ecologist, but that's what we always argue is one of the reasons why we really need to understand not just what our ecosystems are doing now, but what they're going to be doing in the future.
That makes sense. And so my understanding is that you also have worked on the impact of not forests, but trees, sort of scattered canopy, as it were, on mitigating variations in temperature and basically the impact of a more erratic weather system.
Yeah.
Which I'm eager to hear about. And I want to say, as somebody who often walks in the woods, makes intuitive sense to me, because you go into the woods in the summertime and it's cooler. You go into the woods in the wintertime, it's less cold. You know,
right.
You have that immediate sensation that it insulates in certain ways. So
yeah, for sure. Like, forests are a bit of a thermal moderator. Right. So we've been talking a lot about how the climate affects forests, but it goes the other direction too, at global scales, of course, in how they are removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, but also how they impact the water cycle. And at local scales, of course, shade is an important way that trees can cool things off. But transpiration, so the movement of water from the soil up to the atmosphere through trees, is in a lot of ways analogous to the cooling effects of us sweating. So like trees, we can kind of think of as like the sweat glands across the landscape. They move water to the atmosphere way more efficiently than just evaporation from the soil would occur. And that movement of water to the atmosphere, it changes the state of water from liquid to a vapor, which actually consumes heat. So that process takes heat out of the atmosphere and cools things off. And it's through that process of transpiration and through shading and changing the color of the Earth's surface that the trees in and around our communities are able to have a pretty profound role on what our local climate conditions are like. You can see this quite clearly if you look at maps of the surface temperature of a landscape, like New York City, it's really extreme. If you're looking at just a map of temperature, you can pick out where all of the parks are because they're all substantially cooler than the surrounding built-up areas. And even in suburban communities, where the trees that we have in our yards and along our streets can cool things off by several degrees. That's important because so far we've seen about a 1 degree Celsius increase in our temperature from climate change. So about a 2 degrees Fahrenheit increase in temperature. And the cooling effect of trees so far can offset that amount of warming. So when we take a vegetated or forested landscape and we clear it for development, there's a certain amount of warming that we're committed to, climate change aside. And so the more that we can bring those trees back, the more we can cool off that landscape, and the better we can do at sort of minimizing the extent to which our development might be exacerbating changes in climate.
Do you think that politicians and city planners are going to start to factor this in?
They do somewhere, right? So in New York City, they recently finished their Million Trees project, which was the most ambitious tree planting project of any municipality, I think, globally. And we are seeing signs of that at a large spatial scale. You can see from satellites, New York City has gotten greener over the past 10 years after a multi-decade decline in how green the city was. Unfortunately, the suburbs just to the north are suffering from pretty rapid declines in greenness. And this is coming on two different fronts. One, there's development pressure. So there's more areas of forest that are getting converted to homes. And on the other, a lot of our trees, especially in older suburbs, are getting to be quite large. And they're at the point where either they can fall down or they get preemptively cut down. And oftentimes they're either not replaced or they're replaced by something substantially smaller that's going to take another 50 years to be able to replace the amount of foliage that that one tree occupied. So I see a lot of interest in figuring out how to at least curb the decline in greenness in smaller cities and in suburbs, if not being able to kind of increase the amount of canopy cover. It's really tricky. I think in a lot of ways, and especially in suburbs, people kind of equate trees with taking down power lines during storms. And so there's that somewhat negative perception of trees or the leaves that they have to rake up, which is a whole other topic. But I think there's less knowledge or less information about A, the benefits of having the trees there, right? So we get frustrated when a tree comes out on a power line and we lose our power for a few hours. But we don't really think a whole lot about the fact that that tree being there is in very real terms reducing our electricity costs each year. There's this great case study from Worcester, Massachusetts, where they had an outbreak of the Asian longhorn beetle, an invasive insect that was killing a lot of the trees in the neighborhoods. And to deal with that, they had a quarantine. They just cut down almost all the trees in a bunch of neighborhoods. And it provided something of an unintentional experiment to look at how did electricity consumption change in these communities before those trees were cut and right after they were cut. And there's been, in some of these neighborhoods, something like a 40% increase in electricity costs during the summer because of the increased need for cooling. So it's not just that they fall on power lines and are inconvenienced, but having them there has real monetary benefits for us. And I think that side, there needs to be better education about. The other thing is, I think this assumption has always been that we have this binary approach to trees. It's either tree or no tree. And there's always concern like, well, if I plant this tree in my yard, it's going to fall on my house one day, or it's going to fall on a power line. And I think we can be a little bit more creative than that. We can think about, well, where are we putting a tree and what's the right tree to put there? Not every tree gets to be 80 feet tall and will take out a power line. And I think there's ways to maximize the benefits of our trees while minimizing the potential impacts on our infrastructure. And I think more and more people are starting to think about it in those terms. It would be great to get our utilities to think about it more in those terms, because they'll just, if one tree comes down, they'll just come through on a street and take down every other tree that might be in endangered of coming down. And I think we can be more creative about this so that we can minimize the risk and maximize the benefits.
Interesting. You want to walk around a little
sure.
bit? Okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, one of the interesting things about this part of the country is that there was so much deforestation here in colonial times. And then the forest has really grown back here. So in some ways, this area is an optimistic story in terms of the ability of nature to return.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, the regrowth of forests in the eastern U.S., you can see the impacts of that globally on the carbon dioxide that's in the atmosphere. Those young forests and going from just pastures to forests, you can head down this way, have made the temperate deciduous forests one of the strongest carbon sinks of any forest biome in the world. So tropical forests are certainly highly productive, but there's so much deforestation in the tropics that as a biome, it seems that they represent a smaller sink for carbon than our temperate deciduous forests. And so that's a great success story and highlights to some extent the resiliency of our forests. And it sort of remains to be seen what happens with a changing climate and invasive species. I think invasive species are a huge concern. Some sort of forested vegetation will bounce back. What it is and what happens in that transition period, I think, is of a lot of concern, and there's a lot of unknowns.
As we walked through piles of leaves, Andy and I compared notes on our forest adventures, where he had seen an eastern rattlesnake. How that very morning, the person in front of me, when I was taking a walk with my dog, had spotted a bear. Andy took me to a beautiful spot called Old Beaver Meadow, one of the places in New York where this animal whose thick fur first brought Europeans to this region has made a comeback, keeping company with birds and frogs and other creatures. Amidst all the devastation we've wrought, it's good to know that given space and time, the natural world can be quite resilient. Before we wrap things up, I asked Andy what has become a recurrent question for my guests in this series.
I wanted to ask you one more question. Maybe we can stop for a second.
Yep.
So I think I've decided, because climate change is such an overwhelming topic, I think I'm going to ask my guests this season if they can suggest one thing that people can do. Because I think it helps to be told something that one can do.
Can I do two pretty different things?
Absolutely.
talk to and pressure your elected officials to be more aggressive about embracing climate change policy. What we do as individuals is really important, and we need government scale action. The scale of the problem and the urgency of it is so great that we need that top-down approach. From an individual basis, I mean, the same thing we think about from almost every aspect of environmental issues, and that's minimize consumption, think about need versus want, and consider what means you're using for traveling, consider what your level of comfort is for conditions inside your house. You know, as individuals, our biggest footprints are oftentimes driving and climate control in our homes. And so even just changing your thermostat by a couple of degrees can have a pretty big impact on what our individual emissions are.
Coming up, episodes with Arbonaut Meg Lohman about what it's like to study trees from the treetops, and with the founders of the Canary Project about the role of art in addressing climate change. If you have a moment, please give In the Weeds a positive review in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen, and tell your friends to listen as well. Thanks. I'll be back soon.
Color going now.
Yeah.
Having not grown up here, it's something that I don't take for granted.
Yeah. Having grown up here, it is something that I don't take for granted.
I appreciate that.
Every year it amazes me just as much as when I was a kid.
Oh, that's great.